Yeah. Yeah, because in a Banach space, you typically define the dual space being linear in both variables in the test. In a Hilbert space, the only reason you use bars is because the dual of a Hilbert space is actually, there's a conjugate linear isometry with respect to itself, right? So, yeah, I'm glad you noticed that. So that bar does not indicate complex conjugate. Indicates closure. And I'll just look up the statement that I had in here. I don't have closure in my notes, but certainly you want it to be closed. I don't remember if this, I copied this out of Rudin's book. I don't remember. It might be, or, well, in any event, whatever I write there has to be closed, so I'm putting a closure sign on it. In fact, it might be without the bar, because it might simply be that X over the range is certainly a well-defined vector space. You don't need... And if the dimension is finite, then it follows. I'm sure that it follows that the range, in fact, must be closed if the codimension is finite. That's probably a theorem. So it could be that Rudin doesn't have the bars there, but there's a previous lemma or something that I missed. So anyways, I wrote all this down ahead of time to save a little bit of time, but of course, if you want to copy it, it takes the time anyways. So on Tuesday I made a mistake asserting that a compact operator on a Hilbert space had eigenvectors. And Nir pointed out at the end that in fact, compact operators from a Hilbert space to itself don't have to have any. And in fact, an example very similar to the one Nir mentioned is in Rudin's book, which I found kind of instructive. If you take H to be L2 of the non-negative integers, S is the shift. So S of X on X1 is equal to 0 X naught X1. Okay, that's the forward shift. And if you define M to be the multiplication operator that Nir mentioned, that is, you multiply the coefficients by 1 over n plus 1, this multiplication operator is, of course, compact. That's just because the coefficients, the multiplier coefficients decrease to 0. However, this multiplier operator still has lots of eigenvectors. I mean, each of the component things is an eigenvector with corresponding eigenvalue, the multiplier. So it actually has... The eigenvectors of this operator M actually span the whole Hilbert space. That's what I mistakenly had in mind. I thought that from this theorem we could somehow conclude that eigenvectors span, but of course they don't. Because in this example, if you look at T equal to MS is compact, and of course the shift gets rid of all the eigenvectors. So T equals MS is compact. The spectrum of T consists of just 0. It's probably easy to verify directly. But in fact, it's really simple to verify that the spectral radius is 0. If you compute powers of this thing, You see, the shift operator keeps taking you further out so that the multipliers keep getting smaller. And if you work out the spectral radius, you easily see it's zero. Spectrum consists only of the point zero, and of course, as Nir pointed out, T is 1:1. So in other words, the only possible eigenvalue could have been zero, but zero is not an eigenvalue because there is no eigenvector. So this is a compact operator on this Hilbert space. It has no eigenvectors at all. So you certainly do not have an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors for this operator. You don't, there's none. So that shows how badly I was off in my thinking on Tuesday. So instead, what is true? Well, there's two settings in which you have information, which you have a sort of a nice spectral theory for operators. One is if X is a Banach space and T is just a compact linear operator from the Banach space to itself. Then you have at least these conclusions. The first then one, of course, is that the spectrum is compact and at most countable. So it's just finitely many things. It has at most one limit point, zero. So the typical picture for the spectrum of a compact operator on a Banach space is that you have it looks like this, and it may or may not include the origin. It has to, of course, be non-empty. That's always, always true. So it has to be at least something there. The example shows it can be as little as the point zero, even for a non-trivial operator. The theorem says that if you take any point in the spectrum that's not zero, you're guaranteed that there are eigenvectors. And in fact, the dimension of the kernel of T minus lambda I is finite dimensional. Oh, I didn't say that. These numbers are all equal. And they're finite. That's important. They're finite. So that in fact, you have lots of eigenvectors of the compact operator. However, they still don't have to span the space. So I'm making a correction to my mistakes from Tuesday when I was assuming incorrectly that compact operators on a Hilbert space had lots of eigenvectors. The example, of course, a modification of what Nir mentioned, of course, shows they don't have to have any. So my intuition was just way off on that point. Okay, so for a compact operator in a Banach space, we at least have this nice picture about the spectrum, the only possible limit point being zero. For non-zero points in the spectrum, they definitely are eigenvalues and the finite dimensional eigenspaces. However, you still don't have any sort of expansion of X as eigenvectors. So now we go to theorem two. This is the other type of spectral theory that works classically, that works well. So now we're on a Hilbert space, and we have a normal operator. So it commutes with its adjoint, and the idea is that it should look reasonably like diagonalizing a matrix in finite dimensional space. So of course, for such an operator, we have the famous spectral theorem. Says we have a spectral decomposition, which, you know, it takes too long to go into, but the idea of it is that the spectral decomposition is essentially a map capital E from this topological space sigma of T. It's a compact topological space. So you look at the Borel sigma algebra on sigma T, and capital E is a mapping into projections on H. So E of a set, a Borel set in here, is a bounded linear operator in H. It's actually a projection. And it turns out that you can recover T by integrating these projections. And the theory is a little intricate, so I'm not going to go through the details. You just integrate the identity map and you recover T from this particular resolution of the identity, it's called. Oh, it's called a resolution of the identity because you get the identity map if you just integrate the function 1. And you get the operator T if you integrate lambda. And of course, this gives you a wonderful symbolic calculus, which is the real point of this thing. And that is, if you were to integrate, let's just say, you can actually integrate Borel measurable bounded functions, f of lambda. And you then define that to be f of t. And it has all the properties that you would like it to have. It agrees with polynomials, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a nice star isomorphism. Anyways, that's all I want to say about the spectral theorem. But if you have the spectral decomposition, and if you let lambda not be in the spectrum, and look at what projection you get from that singleton set, then the kernel of T minus lambda naught I turns out to be the range of that projection, and therefore lambda naught's an eigenvalue if and only if the projection is not the zero projection. Another conclusion is that every isolated point of the spectrum is an eigenvalue. And the third conclusion that's important for us, remember this is now in the setting where we have a normal operator, so this is very special, if the spectrum is countable, then you have this wonderful property that every x and h has a unique representation as a sum of xn's, where xn's are eigenvectors and they're mutually orthogonal for different lambdas. And of course, what we're going to do in a minute, when we get to something called the Schmidt decomposition, we put these two together and we'll see that for a compact normal operator, you do have countably many of these things. In fact, each of the eigenspaces for lambda, for the lambda n's non-zero, is finite dimensional. You can actually replace this sum here as a sum of eigenvectors of the operator T that's compact and normal. And that's the theorem that we're going to use to obtain something called the Schmidt decomposition. No. The shift kills them all. So T has no eigenvalues. Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about this. Yeah, M makes it compact, S makes it have no eigenvalues. First of all, as I said, the spectral radius is zero, because if you compute T, what does it do? It pushes it out here and then multiplies it by 1/1/2, a third, etc., right? If you apply that operator again, then you get two zeros, and you get a product of two factors. And then the next time you get three zeros and even worse. So in the limit, if you take the norm of that operator after three times, the norm is something like 1/(that thing cubed). And then you take the cube root, you get 1/(that thing). But that thing is going to zero. So in the limit, the spectral radius is zero. The spectral radius, of course, is the largest element in the spectrum. So now we know that the spectrum, since it's not empty, has to have something in it. That's the spectrum. So the only possibility for an eigenvalue is zero. And as you pointed out the other day, if you set zero equals T of X, it's pretty easy to see that all the X's vanish. I mean, all the components vanish because you have X1, X0 over 2, X1 over 3. Yeah, the spectral radius is zero. That's what I said. I went through the calculation briefly in the sense that I just showed you roughly what the operator looks like, and the norm looks like, after you do it n times, looks like 1/(n) to the n. So when you take the nth root, it looks like 1/(n), and that goes to zero. So that shows that you can't have any eigenvalues except at zero, and zero isn't one. So yeah, this is an interesting example. I mean, I wasn't aware of this example until you mentioned it. So the theory of eigenvectors for compact operators is not good. However, this Schmidt decomposition we'll do in a second is a good substitute. It basically says that you just have to shift back and forth between two operators, T and T star. But first, let's also just look at this theorem three. This is really simple theorem. It's much simpler than the other two. But this is a different setting. Remember, the first setting was compact operator on a Banach space. Then we had a normal operator on a Hilbert space. And this setting is now just an arbitrary bounded linear operator from one Hilbert space to another. This is, of course, the setting in which we have Hankel operators, right? Except ours are also compact. Here we're just, there's no assumption. So if you have a, so first of all, if T is a bounded linear, then of course T star T is a bounded operator from H1 to itself, and it's also positive. Well, I haven't given, you hit it against X and dot it with X, you get something non-negative just by flipping around the definition of T star. So T star T has a spectral decomposition because it's a normal operator, commutes with itself. That's a non-negative operator. So it has a spectral decomposition like this. And of course, if you just put, you can put any continuous function here and get f of t. So you put square root here, you get the unique positive square root. It, incidentally, if t happens to be compact, then so will the square root be compact. That's probably easy to see, but in fact, there's a more general theorem. If you take any continuous function on the spectrum that's vanishing at the origin, and t is compact, then f of t is compact. In other words, it's continuity of the symbol, and it has to vanish at the origin. And I believe it's almost if and only if in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, if f of 0 is not 0, then f of t is not compact. So it's almost if and only if, at least on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But anyways, so things behave the way we would like them to. So anyways, this A exists by the spectral theorem, so I'm not going to show that. So if it's the unique positive square root, then in fact there is this simple polar type of decomposition for our operator T. And I think the best way to view it is to go through the proof. That's why I put the proof here. So first of all, A is the positive square root. So you first of all notice that the norm of AX is the same as the norm of TX. That's just trivial. You just write it out. Use the fact that A is self-adjoint and A squared is T star T, and you put the T back. Anyways, you get that. And therefore, you can easily then define an operator U that takes the range of A, which is represented by AX, to the range of T, and it will be an isometry because TX is equal to AX. So this defines a linear isometry from the range of T from the range of A to the range of T. You then extend it continuously, and it goes from the closure to the closure. And then you extend it. Now, of course, at this point, you might say, gee, it would be nice to make it an isometry on the whole space, maybe even a unitary map like onto. But of course, you may already be onto. There's no more room. So the best you can do is just define this U to vanish on the perp. So now you have U as an isometry on the range of A, and it's zero on the perp, extended by linearity. Such a thing is called a partial isometry, when it's an isometry on a closed subspace and vanishes on something. In other words, it's an isometry on a part of the Hilbert space. Yeah, that follows from this. Doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Just look at A of X1 minus A of X2.
Have the same kernel. Yeah.
So this is a nice representation. It's very simple, but it's a very nice representation. Oh, incidentally, it's And also, I've already mentioned that if T happens to be compact, then so is the square root of T, capital A. It's interesting to look at what happens in the example here. T has to have this representation. What's the A and what's the U? Okay, I actually didn't work out T star T, but T star T looks like, I'm just guessing now, it's something like X goes to, I think it's X naught over 2, X naught over squared, sorry, that would be 3, 4, something like this. I may have, these numbers may be off by 1, I'm not sure. I did this last night, but I didn't record the calculation. But it turns out that T star T is a multiplication operator, and it doesn't throw anything away. Of course, TT star does. TT star looks like, X1 over something. I don't know what. I'm just guessing again. Something like this. So somehow I have to indicate here, question mark. And if you can easily compute this, it's just really elementary. But it's interesting to note that, if I've got this right, yeah, I you see now that I don't have the calculation, I'm not willing to do it again. It'll take me too long in front of the blackboard. But I do remember the following. And U is the forward shift S. So that in this particular case, T turns out to be S A, S of the square root. That I remember coming to that conclusion. So that gives you an. So you see here, this particular the shift of course is a is an isometry, but it cannot be extended to a. Maybe I shouldn't say any more because I'll get mixed up. But that's what that U, that's what the U is. It's the forward shift. And I suspect that if you applied this analysis to T star, which is also a compact operator on L2, then of course you get T star has this guy as its positive thing. And this one, you lose something. It's the backward shift. So the corresponding U is the backward shift for the other one. Anyways. So let me put question marks on all three of these. This is really an exercise. Something like this is true. Okay, so let's come back to our situation here, the Schmidt decomposition. So take a T that looks like it's in theorem 3, except that now we assume it's also compact. So the only thing we're missing here is that it's is not normal. Okay, so then T star T is positive, compact, of course self-adjoint, and has a unique square root A. A itself is compact, positive. Of course, positive means self-adjoint. It includes that. So it's self-adjoint, hence normal. So both of these theorems apply to T star. Both of these theorems apply to capital A. It's simultaneously compact and it's normal. So thus, A, so thus, and of course, T star T acts on H1. Thus, H1 has an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors. Eigenvectors of A. Let's suppose that the eigenvalues of A are sigma n. And of course, the sigma n's, A being positive, the sigma n's are non-negative real numbers. And let's suppose that xn is corresponding eigenvectors. So there's a little bit of a something to notice here. In this theorem, of course, the lambda n's are just points in the spectrum, so there's no multiplicity. I mean, all the lambda n's are different. This is just a set. Over here, I'm already thinking of, since I also know the operator is compact, all the sigma n's that are not zero have a finite dimensional eigenspace. So that means that for every sigma n in here, for every sigma n that's actually in that's in the spectrum, there's finitely many eigenvectors that you can find, finitely many eigenvectors. So you can actually repeat that sigma n that many times. So in this sigma n, I'm imagining multiplicities. So some of the sigma n's are repeated. They're repeated as often as the dimension of their eigenspace. And then so the xn's actually have eigenvalues sigma n. But now some of the sigma n's get repeated, right? So. It's a separable Hilbert space. Separable Hilbert spaces. So the kernel is a closed subspace where it's finite. That's countable. Yeah, that's important. Yeah, again, I forgot about that. I just imagine in my mind that all my Hilbert spaces are separable, so closed subspaces always have a countable, always have an orthonormal basis that's countable. Okay, so then what do we have? So we'll go over here. So then we can write X, since we have an orthonormal basis, we can write X as just the sum of its Fourier coefficients like this. And then, of course, we have AX is the sum of, when you hit this, you get a sigma n in front. That's the eigenvector, the fact that xn is an eigenvector with eigenvalue sigma n. And then we get tx, which is uax. So now I'm applying theorem 3 that says you get this partial isometry. And remember, the partial isometry lives on H2. Did I mention that? Yeah, from H2 to H2. It lives on the range. And so this is just n equals 1 to infinity sigma n x xn, and then here is uxn. Let me call that yn. So we get this representation, and now we need to get some information about, we already know that the xn's are a orthonormal basis of eigenvectors for A. Hence also eigenvectors for the square of A, which is T star T. It turns out, and it's easy to prove, that these yn's, first of all, they're orthonormal, as we'll show, and they're eigenvectors for TT star. In fact, well, you'll see there's even more true than that, and then we can extend it to an orthonormal basis, where X has the following properties. So first property is that YNs are orthonormal. They need not span, of course. I'm not saying they're a basis yet. Well, they're not a basis. So the following properties are, first of all, the YN are orthonormal. And to see this, it's just elementary. So the first thing is that the norm of YN, which is U of XN, is XN, is 1. U is an isometry on the range of T. On the range of A, and the xn's, remember, are eigenvectors for A, so they're in the range of A. So you get that for free. Then you do the following trick. You look at U of, say, xm plus U of xn, and if we square it, of course, this is U of the sum of the two. That's also in the range, so that's, of course, equal to xm plus xn. These are orthonormal, so you get 2. You can also put an I there. So do the same calculation with an I. Xm plus ixn. Again, they're orthonormal. You get a 2. And now you just expand the two left-hand sides, and you get the norm squared of uxm, which is a 1, plus this guy, which is another 1, that's the 2, and then you get twice the real part of the inner product. That must vanish, because so then you, what you get is that the real part of... Maybe. It's certainly not the identity operator on H2. Yeah, I don't know. Those are, one can try to check it. It may be true. We're going to actually compute. I don't know. I thought of trying to do it that way, but I thought I would just get mixed up. So I'm just explicitly doing everything elementary. But it's possible, you're right. But you do have to be careful. These are like partial isometries, right? I know. Maybe. So you get that 0, and you also get the imaginary part from this one. So you get that they're orthonormal. Two is that T star of Y has a representation n equals 1 to infinity sigma n yn xn. So it looks the same as T, except that you simply switch xn and yn. And that's, well, you just do the calculation. So I guess we'll finally get rid of these theorems. What do you do? So X, say T star Y, is by definition TXY. So now you go over to the formula we have for TX. If you interproduct this with y, you get that thing with a yn interproduct y. So this is the sum, n equals, if it's 1 or 0, I can't see, sigma n, x, xn, and then you get yn y. But now you just, so we've collapsed this one, now you bring this interproduct out. So this will be this guy, it'll be x with this thing. When you put this inside, of course you get sigma n bar, but remember the sigma n's are real, so they're non-negative numbers, don't need that. This guy, of course, you have to take the complex conjugate, so you flip it. And of course you got that. So you get that, that this guy is t star y. And thus we get the following. You just read off from the formulas. For example, what's t of xn? T of xn, if you put xn in there, of course by the orthogonality, you just get sigma n yn. And t star of yn from that formula is sigma n xn. So I guess the way I think of it, the vectors xn and yn are sort of a pair in that neither one of them are necessarily eigenvectors for t or t star, but t takes the almost eigenvector xn to a yn, which is an eigenvector of that. So in other words, if you put the two together, you get that t star t of xn is sigma n squared xn, and t star yn is sigma n squared yn. So the eigenvectors are sort of intertwined. Not exactly eigenvectors, but you see, t takes these special vectors xn and pushes them to the special vectors yn, and t star pushes them back with eigenvalues sigma n each time. So you now see that t star t does have xn as eigenvectors, and the tt star, the other thing, which by the way isn't equal to t star t in general, and because it's not normal, and is sigma n squared yn. Okay, the yn's are orthonormal. They don't span necessarily H2, but we can extend them to a so now you can extend yn to an orthonormal basis of H2. Since what? You just extend it by taking at most countably many vectors perpendicular to all these guys. And the reason that it works, I can't remember what to say. It's because the kernel of something equals the kernel of something. Okay, so what I wrote was because the kernel of U is the range of T perp, which is the kernel of T star. All right. So the kernel of U is the range of T perp. That comes from theorem 3. It was arranged to be that. And of course it's a general fact that the perp of the range of T is the kernel of T star. That's always true. And therefore, when you, these vectors when you go, which are perpendicular, sorry, I can't see it now. But the idea is that they are eigenvectors with eigenvalue zero when you extend because of this. So these yn's, when you extend them, the yn's, of course, span the range of t. Yn's span the range of t. And so the perp of those things are where u vanishes. And or maybe it's just this equality that we need. Maybe we don't even need that. It's just that the so if you want to extend the yn's to an orthonormal basis of H2, you have to add vectors in the perp of this. But they're in the kernel of T star, so they're eigenvalues of order zero. Anyways, so you can assume without loss of generality that the Xn's are an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors of T star T, and the Yn's are an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors of TT star. And that sentence appears in Nikolsky's book without any comment. So this is my route to get to that sentence. No explanation, he just says that. Oh, he gives a reference to Reed and Simon, which I couldn't get. So anyway. Okay, so we have this Schmidt decomposition. There's probably one thing I should say more as we continue this Schmidt decomposition discussion, and that is the singular numbers. So we're still just working in the generality of a compact linear operator from one Hilbert space to another. There's no Hankel yet. We can define singular numbers and obtain the theorem I claimed last time. It was correct, but I didn't give you the right proof. So now define Sn of t, that's the nth singular number, to be the nth over k finite dimensional. So that's in so kn is the collection of operators with finite dimensional range, dimension at most n, and it's the norm t minus k. So you mod out by the finite operators whose dimension is at most n. That's called the nth singular number. But from the Schmidt decomposition, it's really easy, but I'm going to copy it from my notes. It's really easy to see how to compute this thing for the T from the Schmidt decomposition. So, order the eigenvalues sigma n in non-increasing order, that ordering. Non-increasing, yeah. Yes. No, this is sigma n. Sorry, the Sn's are something new I just defined. The sigma n's are the eigenvalues of the square root of T star T. We're going to prove that the sigma n and the Sn are the same. That's the point. But yeah, they're not yet the same. So these are these are the eigenvalues of A. Because last time I claimed that the Sn squareds were the eigenvalues of T star T. That's true, but I didn't give you the right proof. I assumed that compact operators on the Hilbert space had lots of eigenvectors. Of course, they don't have to have any. So it's really a switch. Okay, so order them in this way. Define the following operator, A sub capital N. to be, we had a representation for capital A earlier. Oh, so define AN of X to be, you just truncate the sum. You look at the tail of the sum, starting at capital N. And it's going to be sigma N X, XN. Remember, we had this decomposition. I think this decomposition is often referred to as the Schur decomposition of the norm, compact normal operator when you go from N equals 0 to infinity. So here we're just, AN is the truncation. So when N is equal to 0, this is, of course, just A. Then there's a couple of things we can notice immediately about this. The operator norm of A is exactly sigma n. That's really easy because we have this now in the Schmidt form, right? It's almost like a spectral decomposition. Oh, I mean, it is. So if you want to take the norm squared of this guy, you just inner product it with itself. The xn's are orthonormal. So all you end up getting is the sum of the sigma n squareds x xn squared, right, when you compute anx dot anx. Here you just take out the biggest one. The biggest one is that one, because they're decreasing. We're starting at capital N, remember. So you take out the biggest one, and what's left is the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients of x. So this is just the norm of x squared. So what you get is this is equal to or less than sigma n squared. So obviously the operator norm is equal to or less than sigma n, and you just test over x sub capital N to get that it's equal. Okay, this was something that I also got wrong last time. I'm going to state it was true, but I gave you the wrong reason. With the Schmidt form, it's easy to see that. Okay, so the an is equal to sigma n, and notice that t minus u an, which is of course u of a minus an, is a minus an is just the initial finite sum. So this is just the sum n equals 0 to capital N minus 1 of sigma n x x n times y n. It's that thing. That's finite dimensional. So we see we get one inequality immediately. Also, this is finite, has dimension. Capital N. I was just writing this out on x equals. Just wanted to point out that it's obviously finite. What I wanted to state is that this operator has dimension, and the way you see that is by looking at that. So it has a dimension that's actually equal to or less than n, because after all, the sigmas could be zero for all we know, from some point on. If it's, the thing is initially a finite dimensional operator. But it's typically of dimension exactly capital N. And so, we see immediately that you can put this operator in as a K, which means that Sn of t, so Sn of t, which is the nth of something, is certainly equal to or less than what you put in when you put in this operator. That's t minus uan. But that's, of course, sigma n. Because after all, u is an isometry on the range of A. A sub n is included. I mean, the range of A sub n is included in the range. So when you're looking at the operator norm of something, if you compose it with something that's an isometry on its range, you obviously have the same operator norm. Just look at the definition. So you get that this and the converse is an exercise. I haven't thought about it. The fact that sigma n is equal to less than Sn t. This is intuitively, as long as you stay within the world of things you can compute, I mean, if you had the spectral theorem, looking at the picture, the idea is very simple, because you have these, here's the sigma n's, and here's capital N. And what we just did was we looked at an operator of dimension capital N, that's this one, and we subtracted it off, and what was left was an operator of order of norm sigma N. Well, I mean, the claim is that if you're going to subtract off an operator of norm capital N to try and minimize the norm, this is the best one. If you don't subtract off these pieces, they're going to still be there. At least if you had a spectral decomposition, they'd still be there, and they would contribute to the norm being bigger. So that's why I say it's an exercise. Because I guess these finite dimensional, see, I don't know enough operators, these finite dimensional KNs are of course compact, but they're not normal. But nevertheless, the fact that they have finite dimension probably means that it's really easy to see that if you subtracted off a finite dimensional operator that did not subtract off every one of those pieces, in other words, you look at the pieces here, unless the operator you're subtracting off exactly cancels all of these pieces, you're still going to have, in t minus k, one of those pieces. And I think that should contribute to the norm being at least the little bit that's left. That's my... But I haven't worked it out. But I think it is an easy exercise. Certainly the theorem is true. Nikolsky states it's true. I'm now on the second line of this proof. But I'm not going to go over that anymore. So the singular numbers are the eigenvalues of the positive square root of t star t. Okay, with that, we're now in a good position. To go back and look at our Hankel operators. I still want this one. Okay, so now we look at Hankel operators. Much of what I did last time, or most of it, is still true, and the calculations are still correct with this with this background. But let me give the definitions in a little with a little more care this time. So first of all, the Schotten class. Even though we won't say anything about the case P not equal to 2, we may as well give the definition because it's an important class. So calligraphic G, P, is the set of T mapping H1 to H2 compact with the property that the sum of the singular numbers, right, that's somehow the distance to the finite rank n operators, that this thing, n equals 0 to infinity to the p, which we call the norm in G2, in GP, is
finite.
So you want the singular numbers to be in little lp, and this is for 1 equal to or less than p less than infinity. And by convention, we just say that g infinity is the whole set of compact operators without restriction. So it's just a set of compact operators. So the context here is from one Hilbert space to another. Yeah, of the singular numbers. Or the eigenvalues of the positive square root of t star t. Yes, exactly that. So, also, last time we showed the lemma, so this was done. This is last time. If h1 equals h2, then g2 coincides with the Hilbert-Schmidt operators. Okay, and the last time when I did this for you, I don't remember if I stated something wrong in the proof or not, but at one point I wanted to use that T star T had positive eigenvalues, which comes from the fact that T star T is a normal operator. And I may have just said it follows from the fact that it's compact. That's not true. Well, yeah, I can't remember. Anyways, the calculation we did last time for Hilbert-Schmidt was correct, as long as the references to whatever else were done correctly. I've rewritten it correctly in there. There's still a few mistakes, even though I wrote this yesterday afternoon. There's still a few mistakes, which will get corrected tomorrow. They're just misprints, though. They're not huge mistakes, like the one that I called a correction was a huge mistake. I just had the wrong thing in my mind, and it... that's been corrected. It's just misprints left. So G2 is the Hilbert-Schmidt operators. We also have one other calculation from last time, which is still correct. And that is the characterization of the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, or the G2 norm, the Schottenclass 2 norm of a Hankel operator. Pardon? Oh, that's G. G. Maybe it's an S. I don't know. It's. They use some squiggle in the book. I don't know what squiggle is. Probably it's an S for Schotten. So let's call it weird S. It's a weird S. I don't know. It's some font. Actually, it's probably some font with respect to someone's national language, and I'm insulting them, but so I apologize. The other lemma, but I don't recognize these things very well. I've managed to learn Greek alphabet, but the other ones, not so much. So this was also from the last time. HV, this is, of course, where phi is an L infinity function on the unit circle. This is a Hankel operator, is in this S2 class, which is equal to Hilbert-Schmidt, if and only if P minus phi is in B a half 2 of the circle, and well, depends on how you define the norm here, but certainly equivalence of norms. So if you define it right, they're actually equal, but let's just say H phi is P minus phi B half. Oh, sorry. S2, of course. S2. So the Schotten class or Hilbert-Schmidt norm of H phi is this thing. Compare that, of course, to the fact that H phi as an operator norm from H2 to H2 minus, right, that's the original operator norm, is comparable to P minus phi BMO, or, if you like, the dual of H1, or, if you like, L infinity plus conjugate L infinity. Those are easier to obtain than BMO. So this is Nahari's theorem, and this is Peller's theorem. I'll put Rochberg in quotation marks. He did it independently, but apparently after. So we've characterized the norm of the Hankel operator as the BMO of P minus phi. We've now characterized the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of the operator as the Bessow space norm of P minus phi. Maybe it's also useful at this point to recall that the norm of phi in this space B a half 2, well, I gave you a definition that I can't remember now. I could look it up. It's some form of integral of something. That's not the point I wanted to make. But in showing something about this, we computed that this was approximately the sum n in Z mod n plus 1 phi hat m squared. This is a calculation we did when we talked about the Corona theorem of Nicolau. Remember, we were going to use the T of 1 theorem. We could use the T of 1 theorem on the Burling transform, but I said we don't have to use singular integral theory. Instead, we can identify the boundary values of the Dirichlet space. And we identified the boundary values of the Dirichlet space as this space by showing, first of all, that the Fourier coefficients satisfied this, and then that this was this. Of course, we did this for holomorphic phis, right? We took a phi in the Dirichlet space, and we showed that its Dirichlet norm was comparable to this norm. But now the sum is, of course, equal to or greater than zero, because negative Fourier coefficients vanish. Then we showed that this was comparable to whatever I wrote here last time. Well, if you look at the proof of this part, it's Fourier series. This equality extends even when the negative Fourier coefficients are there. It's the same calculation. It was just Poincaré's theorem with, I don't remember. It had an e to the 2 pi I t minus 1. There was something like this in there. And anyways, if you... It has nothing to do with holomorphic stuff. This was always true. So it's useful to remember that the Bessow space norm is actually an L2 construction. It's just you have these multipliers, roughly mod n. You have these multipliers mod n. The only reason I stick in the plus 1 is because I want to throw in the, to make it a norm, throw in the constant term. So this is already very useful because, for example, from this form alone, you see immediately that the conjugate function is bounded, or the projection P minus is bounded on this space B a half. Because if you had something in B a half, it looks like this. The projection function is you simply set all the negative Fourier coefficients to zero. Well, it doesn't change the norm much. And we'll need to know that after the break. So at this point, I think we've recovered from what I said that was not true on Tuesday, although all the calculations were correct with the right interpretation. So after this, after the break, we'll state one more theorem without proof. It's a famous theorem of Adamian, Arov, and Krein, which says something quite nice. When you're computing the singular numbers, I should still have that on the board. Sn equals, where's the definition of? Here, this definition. If you take for this H phi, a Hankel operator, compact Hankel operator instead of a compact arbitrary. If you put here a compact Hankel, it's enough to take these finite dimensional k's, not any old finite dimensional k, but a finite dimensional Hankel. That's not trivial. I mean, normally that shouldn't be true. This is a very strong theorem. It's enough to take the infimum over finite dimensional Hankels. And of course, that's already a deep theorem. But once we know that, we know what the finite dimensional Hankels are. That was that long theorem we went through a couple of days ago. I called it Kronecker's theorem. Right? They're characterized by p minus phi being a rational function with at most, you know, n poles. Those are the two big theorems that will allow us to then express the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, the Biot-Half norm of phi, which is expressed already in terms of the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, which is expressed then in terms of the singular numbers. And then after we have these other two theorems, we'll be able to express these singular numbers in terms of numbers that are basically rational approximation by finite, rational functions and the distance in the BMO norm. So there will be a connection to characterizing these functions by how closely you can approximate them in the BMO norm with rational functions, finitely many poles. Then we'll be able to show that the linear operator, the nonlinear operator of best approximation in the L-infinity norm preserves this space, because the operation of best approximation, even though it's nonlinear, does not increase. We'll show those rational approximation numbers, which then of course are these guys. And since this space has been expressed in terms of those guys, the norm of this guy can't get increased either, when you take the best approximation in L infinity. And then finally, we have proved Nicolaou's theorem. We won't be able to give all the proof. There's a long proof. What I've just said covers another 2 weeks. So we'll just, but we will prove the interesting part, the fact that this norm can be expressed in terms of the rational approximation numbers, because that's really the key to the whole proof, and it's the surprising part of the theorem. Okay, so we'll meet back again at 5 to 11. And
Hankel operators with dimension equal to or less than n.
Which means that you're allowed to take
the over
a much
smaller set. And still get the same number. It's a very powerful theorem. Yeah, you wouldn't expect this normally to be true, no. And the and the proof, well, we're certainly not going to do it this month, because we only have until noon. But in April, after the conference, my rough plan is to continue once a week rather than twice a week for 3 hours. And I will simply go back and do all the proofs missing here, and then go on to do the other stuff with the Hilbert space theory and the commutant lifting theorem, Farrison's theorem, and all those things, and get to some open problems.
Could you point out why this is remarkable? Because it seems to me not surprising that if this is a Hankel, then you can take the if over Hankel.
Okay, one...
If over a much smaller set, so...
Yes, but this is a special set for that.
One of the reasons, and I'm quoting Nikolsky now, is that in Nikolsky's opinion, the fact that you can take the infimum over finite rank Hankel operators here suggests to him that there should be a projection, a bounded projection, onto the subspace of bounded Hankel operators. So that's from compact operators to, I'll say, to compact Hankel operators, with the property that it does not increase the rank of the operator. So if it's finite, it stays that finite. Because if there were such a projection, then of course this theorem would be trivial. You just project onto the, you just project and you get here onto the compact operator from over there, the T, you get this, and the same projection would then take you to a Hankel operator. And if it didn't increase the rank, then this would be true. So the obvious way to prove this is to come up with a bounded projection onto Hankel operators that does not increase the rank. And Nikolsky claims that such a projection doesn't exist. There is no bounded projection at all. Never mind not increasing the rank. There's no bounded projection at all. So the obvious way to prove this doesn't work. And I think that's the reason it's considered surprising. Because the obvious thing you should do, project onto Hankel operators, doesn't work. Apparently, somebody has proved that there is no bounded projection from bounded operators to Hankel operators. Now, exactly what that means, I don't know, because I didn't look it up, but I think that's the reason why it's surprising. In other words, you have to go to a lot of trouble to prove it, to get around the fact that the obvious proof could not work. Okay, so now we're going to look at the problem of best approximation in L infinity. Incidentally, why would we want to do that? Maybe I should just remind you that Nahari's theorem said that the H infinity, the norm of the Hankel operator H phi, was the distance from phi to H infinity, distance in L infinity. Anyways, I think that was what. I should check these things because they all look alike to me after a while. So Nahari's theorem was distance in L infinity of phi to H infinity, yes. So, you know, here we have L infinity and here's H infinity, and it's not a Hilbert space. I'm drawing it as if it is, but so it's that. It's that distance in L infinity. So we'd now like to study problems of this nature, where you take distance in L infinity of phi to an H infinity, or maybe distance in BMO norm to L infinity, because L infinity is a subspace of BMO, things like that. So let's look at the first proposition. This is a fairly easy one. If F is an L infinity, it's not one that we're actually going to use, but it's a very easy introduction, then there exists a G naught in H infinity such that F minus G naught in the L infinity norm is equal to the distance in L infinity of F from H infinity, which, by the way, is the nth over all G's in H infinity of F minus G. So the first part of the proposition just says that there's a minimizer. In other words, if you take the if you look at the distance from the function f, it's just bounded, from the function f to h infinity, the distance is actually achieved for some holomorphic function g naught. And there's more. It's also the soup. This is by duality. We've done this already. This is the soup, 1 over 2 pi, or at least things like it. We'll give the proof again. It's the soup of this thing, where capital F is in H10 of norm equal to or less than 1. And, of course, that's equal to or less than infinity. So this infimum, by that standard functional analysis, is this supremum. That's all the, we'll give it in the proof, but it's that annihilator stuff for quotient spaces. And there's more. There's more. Let's put that on this up, the rest of it. And the real question we wanted to identify was not so much that the minimizer exists. That's basically the fact that we have holomorphic functions and we can always take normal family arguments to get holomorphic functions, and they will be minimizers. The real question is, when is it unique? Well, it's not always unique. This question came up before, I remember, in some other context that maybe wasn't equivalent to this. But the minimizer is not always unique, and part of the question we want to answer now is, under what conditions do you get a unique minimizer? So, here's the idea. For this L infinity distance problem, there's always an extremal. Extremal means something that achieves it. So there's always an extremal. We can also reformulate the minimizing problem as a soup problem by duality. If, here's the general principle, if there is an extremal for the dual problem, then the extremal for the other guy was unique. It was a very cute little argument. If there is an extremal, see, in this soup, there may or may not exist an F which achieves this soup. If there does, if there's an extremal F, even if it's not unique, as long as there's at least one F which this soup is equal to that thing, then the G naught is unique. That's the sort of standard easy one that is in Garnett's book that we'll give the proof for. The one that we're going to use in the for the approximation theory here is a variant of this, where instead of having this particular soup being achieved, our assumption is that the Hankel operator corresponding to F, HF, achieves its norm on the unit balls.
Is it special for H infinity, or is it general?
Oh, this proposition is exactly as I've stated. There's a meta-mathematical principle that one often gets in. There's a lot of theorems that say if the dual of your problem has an extremal, then in fact the extremal, if you add one, for the previous problem was unique. That's a theme. It's not a theorem as far as I know, in complete generality. I don't know. certainly I've never seen a general statement. I've just seen lots of theorems that say if the dual problem has an extremal, then the original extremal you had wasn't unique. And you'll see the proof. It's very simple. Very simple. It's a very clever, tricky proof. It looks easier in this context than in the next context with Hankel operators. Oh, so then what is that statement? So moreover, if there exists an F naught in H10 whose L1 norm is equal to or less than 1 with 1 over 2 pi, the integral from 0 to 2 pi of little f, f naught d theta, equaling this distance. So in other words, if there's an extremal for the soup problem, then the extremal G naught in H infinity above is unique. And moreover, you get this really nice formula. Well, you get that the difference, F minus G naught, is an extreme L infinity function. This function is actually constant. And of course, the constant is equal to is this distance. Almost every theta in T. So the function F minus G naught is unimodular, meaning it's an extreme L infinity function. It's constant almost everywhere. It's modulus, I mean. Constant almost everywhere. Okay, it's not unimodular, it's constimodular. So somehow, the function that works, if you have this extra property, that there's an extremal for the dual problem, says it in a very nice way. You get as close as possible to H infinity. Extremely nice way. The analogous theorem for Hankel operators will involve even more information involving the inner-outer factorization of functions. In fact, I guess this will amount to the first time we are going to use the inner-outer factorization, which I guess I didn't do when I was reviewing HP theory before, but it's the next step in that theory. Okay, so how do we prove this? It's really simple once you set it up right. And as long as you write out the correct things, it's very short. So, proof. As I said, the first line is this standard thing, which I don't want to go over very much. It's the standard duality, which I'll just copy out so we can look at it. And what are the choices here? The X is L1, the Y is H10, X star is L infinity, and the Y perp is H infinity. So this is just that standard mumbo jumbo, which, you know, is impossible. I mean, it's impossible to figure out unless you actually sit down. You know, I write out the abstract theorem and then make guesses till it works. That's how you figure these things out. So the first line is duality using the Hahn-Banach theorem. That line with those choices gives you exactly the top line there. Gives you this one. That's not the first line. Gives you that equality. Okay. The first equality that's circled is duality.
And let's see, all I wrote here was that a normal families argument shows that an extremal G naught exists. So what would be the idea? Pick a sequence of GNs, bounded holomorphic functions, such that F minus G sub N, an L infinity norm, goes to the minimum. Then those GNs form of course, because of the supernorms are bounded, they form a uniformly bounded sequence. So you can find a subsequence that converges uniformly on compact subsets to a holomorphic function. It's obviously still bounded. But this, sorry, that's it. So it's just a standard normal families argument, nothing special. So the G naught exists and we have the equality. And then of course so those parts were easy. It's the moreover statement that's interesting and a little tricky to prove. So if a dual extremal function exists, F naught exists, that means, as I said up here, F naught in here with norm at most 1 such that this is achieved, then we get the following string of inequalities for which the first and last terms are the same number. Therefore, all the inequalities are equal. And when you get equalities between integrals with properties, you get that the integrands have to have properties, and that's what will give us that plus the uniqueness. Okay. So the distance, L infinity, so I'll try to write small. This has to go across four terms anyway. This is 1 over 2 pi, the integral f minus g naught, f naught d theta, that's because up here, when you put the f naught in this integral, f naught is in the space H10. So an H10 function integrated against any holomorphic function is zero. I mean, certainly, well, against a bounded one. This is an L1, this is an L infinity on the boundary, and since they're both holomorphic, when you integrate, you just get the constant term in the product. But F0 has zero constant term. So there's the product has zero constant term. Okay. It's just the standard thing. They did the integral of this is an H infinity, this is an H10. It's the sum of the Fourier coefficients, n equal to or greater than zero, of G hat n, F hat n, and G hat minus n, f hat n, and when n is positive, these guys vanish. So it's only the sum over n equal to or less than zero. But f hat vanishes for n negative, and also at zero because of H10. Anyway, it's just the standard thing. Always true. It's the inner product of F minus G naught and F naught bar, right? This is analytic and anti-analytic. When you pair them, you get nothing. It's zero. Okay, so this is equal to or less than. So the L infinity norm of F minus G naught times the L1 norm of F0. And that's equal to or less than, because F naught is equal to or less than 1, that's at most F minus G naught, L infinity.
And F minus G naught in L infinity was chosen. We were choosing G naught to be the minimizer. And it equals distance L infinity. I don't know if you like, I could write this in. Equals distance in L infinity, F, H infinity. So you see over here, you were using all the ammunition lined up at once. First of all, F naught is extremal. Well, here, for this F, you can subtract any holomorphic bounded you want. Subtract any one that's extremal. Then, I guess I should say, for any extremal G naught, that would make it more precise. For any extremal G naught, we get this. And because it's extremal, you get this. So now we're in the very happy situation that bounded holomorphic function, anything. But we're going to choose one of the extremals. We don't yet know it's unique, so there could be many we could put there. So we put one of them there. And then, of course, the fact that it's extremal means that this F minus GL infinity is as good as it gets, right? That's the whole point of using an extremal, because then you just get the distance function there. So now what do you get out of this? Well, this term and this term are the same, so in fact, we get equality. In both of these. This is the main one where we're going to get most of the information. Well, I suppose we need them both. So those are the two inequalities which will tell us what. This integral is actually equal to the L infinity norm of this times the L1 norm of that. That's what this says. Okay, implies that the integral 0 to 2 pi f minus g naught f naught d theta is actually equal to L infinity norm f minus g naught times the integral 0 to 2 pi f naught modulus d theta, right? Because that's what this product is. It's equal to that. Yes, yes, it means that this thing is constant, a positive constant. It has to be equal to whatever. Let me write it out and then we'll verify it. So the claim is, the way I wrote it is this, implies this. Hence this, F EI theta minus G naught EI theta over the distance, F H infinity. And here I'm just writing something obvious. There's no content here yet. Minus G naught EI theta is the same as F minus G naught and L infinity. And this, I claim, has to be F naught EI theta bar over the modulus EI theta. So the only way that you can get an integral of the product of two functions to be equal to the L infinity norm of the first times the L1 norm of the second is if this guy here, is equal to F naught bar, but then you would get F naught squared. It's that.
So it's very nice quantity for L1 and L infinity, and it becomes equality to L infinity.
Right. It's the statement that when you have equality in Helder's inequality, you have something about the functions being
related.
And this is the relation, yeah. So you get this. And from this, I think we're done, because this has modulus 1. Actually, this is already interesting in itself, so now when you take the modulus, you throw some information away. the modulus of F minus G naught is constant is equal to that. Oh, no, 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 no. You're a good question, but F0 is in H1 holomorphic boundary values. So, in fact, they're non-zero almost everywhere by Jensen's inequality. That's, yeah. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Yes, I should mention that. Since F naught non-zero almost everywhere, T. Jensen's inequality. Okay, so that's that theorem. Now here's the other one. It's proved in exactly the same, I mean the trick is exactly the same type of trick, except using Hankel operators instead. And it's the one that gives us a great deal of information in terms of the inner-outer function of a holomorphic function. So this one is another similar proposition, but it's a Hankel variation. In other words, instead of saying that there's an extremal for the dual problem, we say that there's an extremal for the norm of the compact Hankel operator. So where does this go? Page 80. Okay. So let phi be an L infinity. Be such that Hankel operator, HV, attains its norm on the unit ball. Of H2. Okay, so we're not assuming that HV is compact at this point. If HV were compact, it would attain its norm. So an example is as we now know, if phi is in VMO, if p minus phi is in VMO, then we know HV is compact, right? That's Hartmann's theorem. HV is compact if and only if p minus phi is in VMO. If we had that, then of course a compact operator does attain its norm on the unit ball, a compactness. But in general, you just need this hypothesis. If the Hankel operator, HV, happens to attain its norm, even if it's not compact, it might attain its norm. If it attains its norm, then there exists a unique F naught in H infinity such that phi minus F naught L infinity norm is the distance in L infinity phi to H infinity. So here you see we're already giving another criterion for uniqueness. So the key point there is uniqueness. Oh, incidentally, in the previous one I forgot to say why it was unique. This gives you uniqueness. I forgot to say that. Because your extremal function for almost every theta satisfies an equation for almost every theta. So that implies unique. I should have said that. Thus, G naught is unique. Again, we throw away a little bit more information by taking the modulus. And F of the I theta minus G naught theta equals the bottom thing, distance almost every theta. Okay, so here we're also claiming uniqueness, but we get it from the fact that the Hankel operator attains its norm on the unit ball of H2, but we get much more. Moreover, we get, as we did in the previous one, we get that phi minus this F naught in modulus is constant almost everywhere. So we've gotten the uniqueness, and we've got the constancy of the modulus of the difference. So in other words, the L infinity function that minimizes the norm here is a function which is constant. I mean, it's, so basically the idea is if you had a function which was, whose L infinity norm was, whose values were, say, bigger than the L infinity, or smaller than the L infinity norm somewhere, you could get closer by readjusting. Even that's already amazing. So we have this. This kind of is the analog of what we had in the previous theorem. But now we get more. And something else. We get, of course, there we had an explicit formula. But now we get the following explicit formula taken to a further extreme. It's lambda hz bar over hz z bar bz bar almost every z in t where what? Let's put this one up. Where lambda is a constant whose modulus is the distance, h is an outer function, b is an inner function. You wanted phi rational here, right? L infinity? Yeah. Actually, all you needed for the result here was that P minus of phi is rational.
I'm trying to confirm.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying that, yes, you're saying that if phi is rational, then this, you just need P minus phi is rational, just the projection being rational. Of course, if phi is rational, its projection is going to be rational. But if P minus phi is rational, so over here, if you had P minus F is rational, the question is, how would you know, using the fact that this F has a P minus that's rational? When you integrate it against an F0, of course, then you're just going to look at P minus of F. That's one thing right away. So in this integral, you can replace F by P minus F. So you may as well assume that F is rational. If F is rational, you can ignore the G-naught. If F is rational, you're just asking, is this sup over H1 functions, does it attain a supremum? Probably the answer is yes. So in that case, I think this theorem also gives it to you. Because if, after all, if you can take that away, if F is rational, it's very explicit, and probably you can show. Yeah, probably. I don't know, but probably. Yeah, you had a.
What is that from the lambda times H bar over P times
C bar? Yeah, so another way, the way we'll often use it is H Z B bar over B. H. So this is outer, inner, and Z. all multiplied together, that's still holomorphic, vanishing at the origin. You take the bar of that and divide by the outer function. So the h bar over h is modulus 1, the b has modulus 1, the z has modulus 1. So this is a function that's unimodular. Oh, okay. So in particular, one of the points is this guy is unimodular. That just means modulus 1. But it's not holomorphic because you're dividing by... Actually, h is outer. Let me just say it's unimodular anyways.
All I'm saying is that I thought you put sigma instead of z bar. That's what I'm saying. In that formula,
you can see. Oh, okay. Oh, you thought that was sigma?
Z bar, I thought that z
was sigma?
Yeah, by the way, it's very similar to sigma.
Oh, capital sigma! I was thinking of little sigma, and I thought your eyes need checking. But no, it looks like capital sigma, yes. You're right. It's Z bar. Okay, so we have those things. And the proof for this so that G naught in H2 unit ball